I have the sad duty this morning to announce that word has come of the death of Mrs. Louise Staley Vance, the daughter of Dr. and Mrs. S.L. Staley. Dr. Staley was the first president of this seminary. Mrs. Vance lived in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. I have been asked to say that Mrs. S.L. Staley is an invalid and that the family requests that we do not try to communicate with her concerning this death that has occurred in that family. But as we engage in prayer, we can remember these and other concerns. And so let us pray together. Eternal God, in whose loving purpose we find our meaning in life, and by whose grace we are enabled through faith to deal with the mysteries of life and of death, we pray this morning for a special portion of thy grace to be upon these whom we have mentioned here and upon others who have particular needs at this time. O thou who art the light of all who seek the truth, and in whose will is our peace, enable us in this hour to think, to follow, to will, to do, through Christ our Lord. Amen. We welcome this year for the Carver Barnes Lecturer, Professor Roger Lincoln Shin, the Reinhold Niebuhr Professor of Social Ethics and Acting President of the Union Theological Seminary in New York City. Dr. Shin has already been introduced. We have benefited from the lectures we have already heard on the general theme, moving off the ethical map, and we look forward this morning to the third lecture on the new genetics and the meaning of life. Following this lecture at 11 o'clock, Professor Shin will be in the class in Christian Ethics, which meets in Appleby 101. We have a few extra seats there, and if there are persons free at that hour who are not regularly in that class, you're invited to come and enter into some dialogue with Dr. Shin and with the rest of us. I have the honor then to present Professor Shin for the third lecture.
Thank you, Dr. Bland. This morning, I'm turning to the second of the two major problem areas in ethics that I've picked to look at this week. And we're going to inquire into some of the interesting issues connected with the new genetics. Now, what's happening here is quite unusual when you stop to think about it. Geneticists often point out that all the history of civilization, all the achievements of the arts, technology, and statecraft have been done with essentially the same human nature. The people today are not genetically superior to our ancestors 10,000 years ago in pre-civilized society. In fact, there is a good deal of suspicion we may be worse, because people with flaws that would have prevented their survival in the past now can survive and pass on their heredity to future generations. So maybe we're getting worse. It's pretty sure we're not getting better. And all this immense human pilgrimage, you see, has happened in the area of culture rather than of biology. Now, maybe that's going to change. It has become possible through genetics to change the basic biological possibilities of people. And we're soon going to see something of what that means. But it does mean initially that we are moving off the ethical map, facing decisions for which there are not any precedents, decisions that nobody ever made before. There are three main possibilities under study and increasingly coming into practice in genetics, and I will take up each of the three in turn, starting with the ones closest at hand, those that we're facing right now, then moving into those a little more far off. And then after describing all three and saying a little about each, I'll make some general comments about the ethical and theological meanings in all of this. Now for the first one, let us assume that you are in a situation of pastoral counseling. A couple comes to you, you were the presiding minister at their marriage. Now they come to you for advice, and one of them has found out, doesn't matter if it's the man or the woman, let's say the man has found out that, he found out rather recently through the death of a relative, that there is a history of disease in the family. He doesn't have it, but he knows it's there. And he has learned from a doctor that he is a carrier of the disease, what technically called a heterozygous situation. He doesn't have it, but he could pass it on to a descendant, and he's a little worried. Should he have a child? And you put the couple in communication with a medical specialist or genetic specialist who says that there's no risk unless the woman also is a carrier. And so they decide to run some tests, and they find out she is. And now, in a very typical situation, they will be told that if they have a child, the risk is one chance out of four that the child will have an ailment that neither parent has, but it's there in the recessive stage. Now they find this out, and they want your pastoral help in making a decision. Should they have a child with a risk of one in four of a serious physical or mental ailment, genetically based? Now, the first thing to be aware of, most people are, but not all, is that if the risk is one out of four, that doesn't mean that the first three kids are going to be okay and the fourth one will have it. It might be the first one that has it. Shall they go ahead or not? They might say, all right, we'll go ahead and take the risk and live with the consequences. And if the child is born defective, we'll love the child and give it every opportunity we can. They might say, this risk is serious enough, we would not wish it on anybody, we will refrain from having children. And until recently, those were the two choices available. Now there's a third possibility that's increasingly being practiced, and you will increasingly encounter it in pastoral counseling. Perhaps some of you all have already. If not, it's going to happen much more in the next 10 years than the last 10 years. That is, the couple can go ahead, conceive a child, then have a doctor make a prenatal diagnosis of the child, of the fetus, and if it is found out that the fetus is seriously defective, it can be aborted and prevent the birth of a live child with his ailment. Is this a good thing to do or a bad thing to do? Now, you see why I say we're moving off the ethical map? There's nothing in the Bible that tells you what to do about prenatal diagnosis. There's nothing in the history of ethics. This was never practiced before very recent times, and now it is being done every day, and you might say every month a little bit more of it than the preceding month. There are a number of techniques of this, amniocentesis, intrauterine photography, the use of ultrasound devices, but the most effective is amniocentesis. This means the insertion of a needle into the woman's body, into the amniotic sac, and the withdrawal of a small amount of amniotic fluid, which then can be grown in a culture, and in it are a few cells from the fetus which can be examined for genetic defects. And already there are a few score ailments that can be detected that way, and every year more are discovered. Now, by this method, you'll never get a guarantee that the fetus is normal. You can get a near guarantee that it does not have this, that, or the other ailment. And we know it works. It is being done on a small scale, day in and day out. We don't know entirely how much risk there is in it. The reliability of the diagnosis is high, not 100%, but quite high. The risk of a catastrophic injury to the mother or child is very small. What we don't know is, to take an example, suppose this procedure would mean on the average the loss of a little bit of birth weight to the infant, or a few points of IQ. This could be, we don't really know, and there's no scientific procedure for finding out for certain. But there are small risks compared with what might be, depending on your judgment, a very big gain. Now, this is one of the most modest of the proposals being made by geneticists these days. It's a modest one because it's not designed to redirect evolution or produce a new breed of mankind. It's designed only to reduce a few very severe, clearly identifiable genetic disorders. But its implications are very far-reaching. If you find out that the fetus has a genetic disorder, there is at present very little possibility of treating the disorder. Now, that may come later, but now there's very little possibility. What's possible is abortion, and it's sometimes said that it's a strange medical practice to treat the disease by destroying the patient. On the other hand, the American Society has decided to accept or at least tolerate the widespread practice of abortion. Even so, abortion following an amniocentesis is different from most abortions. On the one side, you could say that there is a much stronger reason for an abortion here than in many another case. There is a lot of abortions are practiced in order to prevent inconvenience, embarrassment, or just to satisfy whim. If the reason is to prevent the birth of a seriously defective person, you've got about as strong a reason as you can get. And I've heard a spokesman from the Vatican who said that though he personally did not agree with abortion, he would not try to interfere with any parent who wanted an abortion for this reason. He still didn't quite favor it, but it was a persuasive reason. If, for instance, you know that a fetus has the Lechnaian syndrome, which is a disease that means mental retardation, compulsive self-mutilation, and usually death in childhood. Only the most absolute anti-abortion position would say you should not have it there. On the other side of the case, there are reservations about abortion following amniocentesis that do not apply more generally to abortion. The rationale that supports abortion in most cases is the rationale that the fetus in its early stages is not a person. I know that can be debated, but that is the rationale. That is, here's a tiny physical mass of material that doesn't look like a person, that doesn't think, doesn't feel, doesn't have blood circulation like a person, and so on. And it said, that's really not destroying a person. And amniocentesis has to come pretty late in fetal development. It comes about the 18th to the 20th week. By this time, the woman has felt the fetal movements within her body. The fetus has a measurable heartbeat and brain activity. It is close to the stage of viability. An abortion at that stage seems because it's so hard to define exactly what personhood is, seems much more like the destruction of a person. And the emotional investment of the parents is much greater than at an early stage. And so I know women who are strong advocates of the legal right of freedom of abortion who say they would not endorse abortion after amniocentesis without a grave reason. Now, a few women want it without a grave reason. Doctors are getting a few requests now after amniocentesis to abort a fetus because it's not the sex that the parents want. Most doctors will refuse to do this. As I say, to be male or to be female is not a disease, and I will not abort a fetus for that reason. A few doctors will, and given the nature of things, if a few will, the possibility is there. If 1 out of 100 will, the person wanting the abortion can shop around and find the 1 out of 100, and this is likely to increase unless there sets in a very strong social, cultural mood against it. There are proposals today to make amniocentesis a routine procedure required in pregnancy, almost like a syphilis test before getting a marriage license. Most doctors do not favor the requirement. They favor the optional amniocentesis when there is something in a family history to indicate a risk, or in the case of older women who are more likely to give birth to children with Down syndrome, sometimes called mongolism, than are young women. It's now practiced on a selective basis. I say a few people would like it made routine. Now, that's the first case I want you to think about. And I present it first because you are going to face that one in pastoral counseling soon, if you haven't already. This is, in practice, becoming more common. Now I'm going to move to things a little farther off, and you really don't have to decide, for the sake of a ministry, how you would act about these next week. They won't come up next week. And yet the importance of thinking about them is that they do force us to think deeply about the meaning of personhood and human existence. And so I move to the second one, selective breeding. Now, this is an old, old idea. Plato advanced it in the Republic, but the science at that time was so primitive that nobody really knew how to do anything about it, and it wasn't taken up in any elaborate way at all. But Plato's argument, and that in many sense, is that we deliberately breed cattle to bring out the characteristics we want. Isn't there all the more reason to do it with human beings? Or you might say human beings are enough different from cattle that there's all the more reason not to do it there. And that's why this is a question of the meaning of human existence. Well, today we know a lot more than Plato did, and we can do a lot more than people could do in Plato's time if we want. Let's start with the most obvious possibility. Artificial insemination by donor is in practice now. The purpose is to enable a couple to bear a child, even though the husband is apparently sterile. And genetics is not a major consideration, except that usually the superintending a physician tries to get a healthy sperm donor whose genetic makeup is not radically different from that of the husband in the case. It has been pointed out that the physician usually secures the semen from a medical student, both because medical students are always available around hospitals and because physicians just naturally know that medical students do transmit a good inheritance. It's even been reported on occasion that a physician, this is regarded as unethical, but that he has secretly used his own semen with the double purpose of providing an ideal heredity and pocketing the fee. But for the most part, aid or artificial insemination by donor is regarded as a remedy for sterility, not as a genetic device. But there are those who advocate using it deliberately for genetic purposes. And just as champion stallions and bulls sire many offspring, so ideal human males might do the same. As in the case of animals, it's quite possible to freeze human sperm to increase their potential utility. Frozen sperm banks are already in operation in several parts of the country. At the moment, the purpose is to preserve the semen of men who've undergone vasectomies in case later they should want to become fathers. But the practice is already old enough that for some preliminary findings, the press reported in 1971 that one young man conceived with frozen and then thawed sperm had reached the age of 17, was in excellent health, and if you're interested, was an A student. It can be done. Now, the late Hermann Muller, who was a distinguished and enthusiastic geneticist, proposed that the sperm of distinguished men be preserved and made available for the procreation of many offspring. Now, Muller was aware that there's a deep stubbornness in men, men like me, who in our vanity might prefer to pass on our own mediocre heredity than rear a child born by normal processes of our wives who genetically had a far superior heritage to any we could pass on. And so Muller made the concession to somebody like me, all right, have it your way, the first kid, but on the second, at least be socially minded enough to go for a better inheritance. Muller was aware that our estimates of our contemporaries, of who would be ideal fathers, tend to change rather quickly. In fact, in his own case, when he'd make up lists, in his early lists, Lenin was always on the list. In his later lists, Lenin was conspicuously absent. Darwin was always there, but Lenin off, on, and then off. And so he said, let's not be rash. This is the value of the frozen sperm bank. You can let 20 years lapse after the death of the individual. This gives history a better chance to size him up, you know, and know whether he's really the father you want or not. Then you make your decision. Now, obviously, this whole thing can be speeded up if you can select genetic mothers as readily as genetic fathers. And so laboratory experiments are going on in the production of test tube babies. The idea here is that you fertilize the ovum in vitro with the expectation then of implanting it in the ovum of the woman who will bear the child. Those who like this call it prenatal adoption. Adoption is ethically desirable. Why not prenatal adoption? In 1971, at the International Symposium in Washington, sponsored by the Kennedy Foundation, Robert Edwards of Cambridge University, England, described work he's doing in vitro fertilization. James Watson of Harvard, one of the discoverers of the double helix structure of DNA, then publicly asked Edwards to stop his work, saying, "You're bound to make mistakes, you're bound to produce monsters, and then infanticide will follow." Edwards said, "I won't stop, I'm going to go ahead." I've had some chance to talk with Edwards about this since, and I gather from him his intention is not really a mass genetics program. What he combines is a kind of a scientist's enthusiasm for pure research with a desire for medical knowledge that will prevent some diseases, and that's the reason for his experiment. But others are advocating it as part of a genetics program. Now, the freezing of ova is much more complicated. Please, there's no male chauvinism here. It's just in the nature of the case. An ovum's bigger, more complex than a sperm. To freeze and thaw is more complicated than doing it with a sperm. But it has been done with calves successfully. And there is some reason to think that maybe it can be done with human beings. Now, you can really let your imagination go on this one if you want. And imagine what are sometimes called genetic supermarkets, where man and woman, now this assumes that something like the family survives, as if you want my opinion, I hope it does, but father and mother with a genetics counselor make their selection of the genetic parents, not the familial parents, the genetic parents of their offspring. And they figure out their ideals, and maybe you decide we'll match a Joe Namath and a Jane Fonda, or a Spiro Agnew and an Angela Davis. And then the minute you start thinking that way, you become aware that you were thinking not only about a traditional way of procreation that may have real importance to us, you're thinking the whole question of what it means to be a human being and what you mean by desirable human qualities and undesirable human qualities. And it's fairly simple to say that it's undesirable to have cystic fibrosis, a genetically based disease. It's much more problematic to try to prescribe the personality types and their genetic bases for the future. There are a lot of other complicated little aspects of this too as you start thinking it through. For one thing, it might result in what scientists call a narrowing of the gene pool. The gene pool is presently diverse has all kinds of potentialities in it that don't particularly interest us living in this climate, this form of civilization, that might be very useful in another time and place. You can imagine what would happen. Would the world be filled with siblings and semi-siblings who didn't know this? And would the result then be a lot of incestuous marriages? Again, if marriage persists, as I for one hope it does, it's sometimes suggested that in such a world, everybody wear a coded tag, like the army dog tags, and by the time you get to romantically inclined, you match your coded tag with your potential partners and find out if maybe you are both genetically the offspring of the same parents, though nothing in your family life would lead you to think of this. What did this do with the Oedipal complex? Which father would I hate, my familial father or my genetic father? What would it do with sibling rivalries? I say to my brother, my genetic father was a great athlete and yours was only a president of the United States. So on. And though these questions are amusing, the almost total ignoring of them in the genetics literature is just one sample of what happens with the specialization of knowledge of our time. People get to writing one hobby and don't think of the questions that they would ask if they were coming from another discipline. All right, selective breeding is, I say, the second of these major possibilities. It's farther off, except that the sperm banks are now in operation and AID is now in operation, and the two could be combined at any moment, and for all I know are in a few cases right now. The third is the most complex and is still farther off, and we're not quite sure how far it'll go or how far it can go, and that is usually called genetic engineering. This involves the mechanical or chemical manipulation of genetic materials for the sake of specific desired goals. Now, one of the possibilities that you read about a great deal is cloning, which is simply asexual reproduction, in which the child gets the heredity not from two parents, but solely from one. The child is a genetic duplicate of one parent. Now, this can be done with frogs. Whether it can be done with human beings, we don't know. There are a good many predictions that it can be within 10 or 15 years. Now, you might ask, what possible advantage is there to this? I can imagine a deep craving for this in, say, the ancient Egyptian society, where if they'd had it, pharaohs might have sought a kind of immortality through genetic replication instead of through building pyramids. In a society that's learned to value the unique individuality of every human being, the reasons why anybody would want such a duplication are more obscure. I suppose there are persons so infatuated with themselves that they would like descendants who duplicate their own genetic constitution, unadulterated by fusion with a sexual partner's heredity. Or I suppose there are hero worshippers who yearn to replicate their human idols. Many of the conjectures about cloning are naive in their assumption that a genetic replica would have the same personal qualities as the genetic parent. Well, this is not the case, because a person is a meeting of certain given potentialities with a historical situation. And personality is not transferable from generation to generation, though certain capacities are in part transferable. Another form of genetic engineering sometimes called genetic surgery or genetic hybridization, is the attempt to rearrange the DNA as the macromolecules that carry the genetic code so as to modify it for genetic purposes. Now, this is a process fantastically intricate. Here's the basic data. The fertilized human ovum is about the size of a millionth of a pinhead. It contains coded information equivalent to about 1,000 printed volumes of books, each the size of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, if in that mass there is one bit of coded information that is passing on something harmful that you'd like to eliminate, is there a way of going in there and replacing it with something better? Now, this is not just a miniaturized appendectomy, you can see. And some of the world's foremost geneticists say there's no reason to think we'll ever be able to do it. Some others say we just might be close to the breakthrough. The method involves chemical or bacterial action, and it is possible that the bacteria or chemicals might move in and with some kind of chemical affinity move to the right place and do the right thing. It could happen. The reason for mentioning it is not that you're going to encounter this one in pastoral counseling next week, but it does raise some very interesting theological questions about what it is to be human and what we want our humanity to be. On a simple basis, I would say that if it were to work, in certain ways it would be ethically very desirable. We now perform surgery to prevent defects after birth. If you could, with a reasonable expectation of success and without undue risk, prior to birth, prevent defects, who would object to that? Well, now I've described three possibilities. One already in practice, the second close at hand as a possibility, the third farther off. I'd like to back off now and look at all of them in the light of my topic, the new genetics and the meaning of human existence. See, all these possibilities touch on perennial human and ethical issues. What is the human good? What is progress and what is corruption? What does it mean to Christians who believe that people are created in the image of God to start activities designed to modify the basic constitution of this human nature? If we look at the general ethical issues, one thing we must pay attention to is the relationship between experimentation and risk. Now, this is an issue that comes up in all medical experimentation, and a lot of thought is going to it these days. Experimenting on people means risks to people. A responsible experimentation minimizes the risks. That is, it moves cautiously, it starts with animals, and carries out every precaution it can, but finally there comes the stage when to experiment on a human being. And what's the ethics of this? Scientists like to talk in experimentation about what they call a cost-benefit analysis. And on some experiments, if by the best calculation, probable gains outweigh probable losses, you say the risk is justifiable. Yeah, there'll be some losses, but there'll be greater gains. But you can't quite do it that way when people are involved. Can you say, I'm willing to sacrifice 100 people in order that 1,000 may gain? something about our humanity, something about our faith says this is a different process of reasoning. Let me give you an offhand example. It is quite possible, quite easy, by irradiating seed to increase the rate of mutation. And you might, as a scientific experiment with a clear conscience, subject a lot of plant seeds to radiation, plant them, and see what you get. And you'll get some knowledge, for one thing. And out of these mutations, the vast majority will be inferior to what you started with. A few will be superior. And you might say, if 1% are better, throw away the 99%, you've got a gain. And if you do this with plants, probably there won't be much moral objection. If you do it with the fruit flies, probably not much moral objection. If you do it with dogs, there'd be a lot of complaints. Would anybody do it with human beings? See, the cost-benefit calculus changes because we believe a human life is precious. In particular, people in a community who've heard the parable of the 99 sheep and the one are not readily going to hurt even one to help a whole lot of others, much less are we going to hurt many to help a few for the sake of the future. So the element of risk is an important one and rather different from what it is in other kinds of experimentation. One other aspect of experimentation comes up here. The standard formula in medical experimentation requires informed consent of the subject of the experiment. And medical ethics is giving a lot of attention to what is informed consent, and that's a lot harder to work out than it might seem to be at first glance. But when the subject of the experiment is a fetus, there's no such thing as informed consent possible. And so the element of risk becomes important. And I would think that as Christians, we'd say there's no life without risk. Our faith has taught us that. But dare those in power subject the powerless to risks that the powerful don't themselves assume at all? Surely there's an ethical problem here. The second one has to do with the relation of humanity to nature, whether you're talking about our physical nature or our given created nature. The phrase that's often used here in relation to some of these new ideas is the phrase playing God. Do we have a right to play God? If we believe that God has created us, are we going to mess around in, tamper with, and hope to improve on that creation? I think we must be careful not to get trapped by our language here. Surely, we've always believed in Christian faith that the human person is akin to nature, made of the dust of the earth, related to the animals, yet in some sense transcendent to nature, able to make decisions, choices, realize purposes, and adapt physical nature to human needs, tend the garden as Adam and Eve were bidden to do. That is, nature, just as it comes, is not our total ethical norm. We do try to improve on nature. Now, in some ethics, particularly traditional Catholicism, nature was a norm. But even then, it was a nature in a kind of an Aristotelian Thomistic sense, not just nature as you happen to find it. And all medical practice is a modification of nature. The taking of the simplest medicine, any form of surgery, is a modification of nature. So we must not assume a priori that any time we try to improve on our given physical nature, we're playing God in an irreverent sense. We may be serving God using the capacities God has given us to exercise our God-given freedom and purposes. And yet, there come points at which the relation of our selfhood to our given nature becomes a serious issue, and we really have to ask, do we sometimes manipulate ourselves and other people in a dehumanizing way? Let me give an example here that does not come from genetics, but you can make the application. It is possible, Delgado has done this with animals, to implant electrodes in the brain of a bull or an ape, then send it radio signals that affect its behavior. And Delgado's done some fascinating experiments this way. It's expected that this is possible with human beings, and I don't know just how far experimentation has gone, because some of this experimentation is rather secret. But it is proposed, at least, that electrodes can be planted in the brain at certain centers of pleasure and pain, and then somebody outside operating a kind of console can flash signals that'll relieve your pain or give you a constant sensation of pleasure. Just sending these electrical impulses to keep a person, if you can still call this a person, in a sort of state of continuous, stupid, orgasmic happiness. Now, most people regard that as ethically offensive. But already, Sir Julian Huxley, who died just last week, said of it, after all, electric happiness is still happiness. And happiness is very much more important than the physical happenings with which it is correlated. Well, I have to disagree, but I have to report that that opinion is part of the ethical mix today. Now, if the issue concerns not electrodes, but the manipulation of DNA so as to produce better human beings, if we know what better is, how do we deal with that? Are we destroying something precious in our nature, something God-given in our nature? Or are we, as we, when we take medicine for illness, improving upon our nature in a thoroughly ethical way? We're going to have to do a lot of thinking about that one. Since we're going off the ethical map, I'm not going to tell you the answers to these questions, though I don't mind at all telling you my own feelings at the moment. I think there is something inherently good about the procreation of babies as a consequence of the unsuperintended intimate act of affection of husband and wife. That does not mean that thought cannot guide affection, but it does mean that we better ask some serious questions about the relation between our natural human vitalities and calculated manipulation. The last ethical issue I'll mention has to do with the criteria and loci of decisions. Every effort at genetic improvement assumes some judgments as to what is good and what is bad. Now, even on the technical level, those judgments are difficult. Theodosius Dobzhansky, one of the best of American geneticists, has said, "Does anybody know what will be best for mankind centuries or millennia hence? No heredity is good regardless of the environment." There's a lot we don't know. And then you get on a more fundamental level, it gets harder and harder. Now, Hermann Muller, who is whom I mentioned earlier, about the most ambitious of all geneticists, saw the difficulty. He worried once in a while about the possibility of a germinal race akin to armaments races. I used to get a little fun out of imagining that meeting of the National Security Council at which the CIA reports that the Russians, the Chinese, have cracked the genetic code and are producing a race of superior warriors. And then I saw the launching of an Operation Genoir, akin to the Manhattan Project that produced the atomic bomb. And I assume this is all sheer speculation. Till one day I read press reports that the Russians were worried that the United States was applying genetics to warfare. I mean, that could happen. Mueller himself put improved character right alongside better physical constitution and higher IQ as the aim of genetic development. Only nobody really knows the genetic basis of character. That's just beyond us. But Mueller wanted that, and then he kind of worried about it because he said present society had such corrupt values that he didn't really have much confidence we would choose the better genetic character for the future. Well, this becomes especially problematic when you look at the past and see how much sheer prejudice, even viciousness, has entered into human planning. Eugenics movements, for instance, have been filled with racial prejudice, trying to perpetuate certain types that people thought were good, when all they meant was types like themselves and not others. And some of my work in this area has been with black geneticists who are particularly sensitive to this, who realize that if a certain people got control of sophisticated genetic processes in the past, black people might have got wiped out when they've got as much to contribute as anybody else to the beauty and the wonder of human diversity. There are other issues of decision making here. If sperm and ova are to be dispensed from frozen banks, will they be sold by corporations at a profit? If expensive genetic engineering becomes a practice, will only the wealthy practice it? At what stage will government regulation enter in? It surely will at some stage. Dobzhansky asks, are we to have, in place of Plato's philosopher king, a geneticist king? Who will be president of the National Sperm Bank and of the National DNA Bank? What checks and balances are to be imposed on the genetic legislator and the genetic executive powers? Who will guard the guardians? We come back to the fact that there's no technical answer. The answer, finally, is that is the answer to possibilities raised by technology is in the area of human choices and human values. And at this point, some of the foremost scientists are giving us serious warnings. Nobel laureate Marshall Nirenberg says, when man becomes capable of instructing his own cells, he must refrain from doing so until he has sufficient wisdom to use this knowledge for the benefit of mankind. Another biologist, Robert Morrison, says, the thing that has saved man from his limited visions in the past has been the difficulty of devising suitable means for reaching them. Now suppose we're about to discover the means. This could be a wonderful opportunity to accomplish worthwhile ends that have been blocked off from us in the past. It could mean a vastly increased capacity to achieve the unworthy ends toward which so much of human activity is directed. The way out, I suppose, the way ahead, I suppose, is an ethical vision not left just in the area of vision, but incarnated in the midst of our common life. And that somehow is a little harder to bring off than the sheer technological process. And so I end with the words I ended with yesterday. what's involved here is that area of human aspiration and purpose that has mysterious roots, but to which we, particularly in the Christian community, but to some extent elsewhere in mankind, refer with such words as freedom, judgment, and grace.